Let's kick off another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by getting back to the book of Isaiah, chapter number 40. We're working our way through this last big chunk of the book of Isaiah, which focuses an awful lot on the foolishness of idolatry and the reality that God is creator and that he is the only God and that he is looking out for us. He is even sending us salvation through Jesus, he who is salvation. And so in Isaiah chapter 40, we're going to start at verse 27. God has just been going over this idea that he is the creator, that there is nothing that exists without him having put it into place, and that humanity and creation itself is nothing compared to him. And then he calls the Israelis on the carpet. Remember, Isaiah is passing this on to the Israelis of his time, that is the late 8th century BC, that they need to adjust their attitudes toward him. So Isaiah 40, verse 27, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, quote, 'My way is hidden from he who is, and my right is disregarded by my God,'" end quote. So apparently some of the Israelis were trying to say, well, God's not watching me. He doesn't know anything I'm doing. Or perhaps, he doesn't know anything that's happening to me. Why are my rights not being upheld by God? Why is he letting this stuff happen to me? Or why is he stopping me from doing the things I want to do? God doesn't care about me. And so the response that follows is powerful. Isaiah 40, verse 28. "Have you not known? Have you not heard? He who is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable." So God is above creation. He is outside of creation. He is outside of time and space. Everything that exists, exists because of his action. And so he is not unable to deal with things. He doesn't wear out. He doesn't faint over time. He doesn't die and disappear. And he knows everything that's going on. So of course he's aware of what each of us as individuals are doing, the motivations behind those choices, and whether or not the things that are happening to us are appropriate or too much. He knows all of that. So verse 29, "He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength." So God intervenes to help the people that are having a super hard time. This is probably a good time for me to bring in one of my favorite memory verses in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 10, verse number 13. The larger context of chapter 10 is that everything that happened in the past, specifically to the Israelis during the Exodus, all of those things were written down to help us learn from their mistakes or learn from their proper choices, and to realize that God can be trusted. Now listen to 1 Corinthians 10:13. "No time of testing has come upon you except that which is common to all mankind. And God is faithful," meaning he can be trusted, "in that he will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able. But with the testing, He will provide a way of escape that you will be able to endure it. That is an absolute across-the-board promise to every living human being, that God will never put you in a lose-lose situation. He will never allow you to be put into a lose-lose situation. He will always provide a way for you to do the right thing and get through it to the other side. Now, a caveat to that. That doesn't guarantee that you'll survive it physically. The way through it might mean dying. But as Jesus said, be faithful even unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Here in Isaiah chapter 40, God makes the promise that he gives power to the people that are faint. He gives them enough to get through it. To him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. There are times that even the most fit people, the youngest people with the best oxygen, carbon dioxide exchange in their life, in their lungs and in their muscle mass, even they can be sometimes pushed to the limits of their physical ability. But they who wait for he who is shall renew their strength. So, waiting on God is the key. Trusting him, looking for the way of escape, looking for the way of enduring. We have to wait for God to lead us. And then we will renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. You know, you like to see the big birds like the eagles soaring high in the sky, you know, taking those thermals and just moving their wings just slightly and soaring farther and farther up into the air. That's what God says we can do if we will just trust him. He will be the wind beneath our wings, if I can borrow the phrase from that secular song. They shall run and not be weary. Wow, wouldn't that be great? To be able to just run and run and run and run and run and never get tired. My suspicion is that our new bodies, once we're in eternity, will have such a perfect oxygen usage that we'll be able to do exactly that. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. What a great promise for eternity. But it's also the promise, metaphorically, that whatever comes our way, God is aware of it, and he will give us what we need to get through it to the other side in honor of him. Again, the caveat, it might mean laying down our lives. Think about Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When they were told that if they did not bow down before the image of Nebuchadnezzar, they said no. Nebuchadnezzar, because they worked for him and he respected them, gave them a second chance to change their mind and do it. And he told them, don't you dare think that your God can get you out of this. When I've told you to do this, you need to do it. And no God's going to be able to help you out. And their response was, oh, great king, our God could get us out of this. He could rescue us out of your hands. But even if he chooses not to do so, we will not bow. See, they understood that doing the right thing might cost them their life. But that was okay, because you have to do the right thing no matter what. And God will get you to the other side. Back to our Isaiah passage, Isaiah chapter 41. Listen to me in silence, O coastlands. Anytime you see the word coastlands in our English Standard Version here, and I think some of the other passages or some of the other translations do the same thing, don't think just shorelines. Think Borderlands. Okay? So listen to me in silence, oh borderlands, edges of nation locations. Let the peoples renew their strength. Let them approach, then let them speak. Let us together draw near for judgment. So all those people groups need to pay attention. They need to shut up and listen, because judgment is coming. Verse 2, who stirred up one from the east, whom victory meets at every step? This is a rhetorical question. It's God that did it. Whether we're talking about the Assyrians coming out of the east, remember the Mesopotamian area was referred to by that title, the east. And so it doesn't matter that the east was north of the promised land. It's still referred to as the east. And so the Assyrians in Isaiah's day are the ones coming to do God's judgment against the lower Middle East. The Babylonians later will come from that same region. They'll take over the Assyrian Empire. And we know that the book of Isaiah speaks to Babylonian things ahead of time. Cyrus the Great, he takes over the Mesopotamian area. And he also, therefore, kind of comes from the east toward the lower Middle East. And so maybe that's in mind here. But whatever it is, it's God's judgment. He's the one that's allowing those from the east to come. Verse number 2 continues, he gives up nations before him so that he tramples kings underfoot. He makes them like dust with his sword, like driven stubble with his bow. So God allows this invader to do great damage, to just steamroller over the lower Middle East. He pursues them and passes on safely by paths his feet have not trod. Who has performed and done this? Calling the generations from the beginning. So, question at the beginning of verse 4. Who allowed this to happen? Who's carrying this out? Who is the ultimate one that's involved in this judgment that's coming? I, he who is the first and with the last, I am he. So even though it might be carried out by the Assyrians, later by the Babylonians, later by the Persians, later by the Greeks, later by the Romans, and ad infinitum, God is the one that is ultimately controlling what happens. And it is in pursuit of judgment. The coastlands have seen, and they're afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and come. Everyone helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. So we've got to buck up under the pressure of this invader. But then they do something that God is critiquing them over. Verse 7, the craftsman strengthens the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer, him who strikes the anvil, saying of the soldering, oh, it's good. And they strengthen it with nails so that it cannot be moved. That is describing the building of an idol. As the judgment comes, the knee-jerk reaction of some of these folks is to go and have a new idol made. Have it carved out of wood for its base, and then have the metal workers put something over the top of it, take care of the creases, smooth it out. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to nail it down. Don't forget to keep it from tottering. We don't want it falling over. And God is like, are you kidding me? I'm trying to get your attention here to my creative blessings upon you from day one of the universe. I've called you to repentance. I'm sending judgment to help with that. And your response is to retreat back into idolatry. Verse number 8. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corners, saying to you, you are my servant, I have chosen you and not cast you off. So God is specifically zeroing in on the Israelis, the southern Judeans through Isaiah. And he wants to appeal to them from their history already, because God has particularly worked with this ethnic group, this family, since the time of Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, who becomes Israel. God says, I brought you guys this far. Verse 10, fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. So trust me. I'm here to help you. Don't resort to the idols. Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame and confounded. Those who strive against you shall be not as nothing and shall perish. So God gives them the promise. If you will just trust me, I'll deal with those that trouble you. You shall seek those who contend with you, but you shall not find them. Those who war against you shall be as nothing at all. So if you'll just trust me, none of this is going to be a problem. For I, he who is your God, hold your right hand. Is it not I who say to you, fear not? I am the one who helps you. So God is reaching out in this section of Isaiah to Israel, to Jacob, to southern Judah. Fear not, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel. Don't be insulted by that idea of a worm. I know we have some songs and things. I'm but a worm. You know, I am nothing. I'm a maggot. That's really not the thrust of this. It is the idea of a little bitty, maybe glowworm or a little crimson worm. It has no power. It can't take care of itself. And so that's the way it's being presented is, you don't need to be afraid because you're so small, because you can't help yourself. I'm the one who helps you, declares he who is. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Think about who I am. Don't think about who you are. Think about who I am. Verse 15, behold, I make of you a threshing sledge, new, sharp, and having teeth. Now, this is something that most of us in the modern era have to have explained to us. In the ancient world, the processing of grain was multi-staged. You'd have to go out and cut the sheaves out of the field and then transport them to a processing area where these stalks of grain would be scattered on a hard, flat surface. And then, usually with animal muscle power, a tool called a threshing sledge was run over the top of them. Threshing sledge is just a whole bunch of lumber that have little metal teeth underneath. And you put some weight on the top of it, you attach it to like a bull or maybe a donkey, and then you just keep running it over the top of the grain stalks. And the weight and the little metal teeth bite into the grain husks and break it apart. free up the seed. And so God says to Israel, trust me, even though it feels like right now you're the ones that are getting threshed, I'm going to make you into a brand new threshing sledge. You shall thresh the mountains and crush them, and you shall make the hills like chaff. So the shoe is going to be on the other foot soon. If you'll just trust me, you'll be the ones that will be doing my judgment against them. And then, verse 16, you shall winnow them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the tempest shall scatter them. The next step in the processing of grain was to take that threshed bunch of grain and to just start throwing it up into the air using winnowing forks or winnowing paddles, and the prevailing wind blowing across the winnowing area would blow the lightweight chaff to the side, and the heavier seeds would drop straight back down. And so God says, if you'll just trust me, not only will I use you to thresh them, I will use you to winnow them, to find out what few bits and pieces among them are still worth saving, and then the chaff will be blown away and dealt with. And you shall rejoice in He who is, and the Holy One of Israel, you shall glory. In the Holy One of Israel, you shall glory. So if you just trust me, everything will work out. Verse 17, when the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, He who is, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. So when the tough times come and everybody's thirsty, whether that's literal or metaphorical, doesn't matter. If they are hungering and thirsting after righteousness, I'm going to step in and help them out. If they're hungering and thirsting after physical food and water and they trust me, I'm going to help them out. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. Now, he's already done that in their history. The whole time that they were in the wilderness experience, 40 years, he always provided water from a rock at or near their camping location. And so they always had plenty of water. And then, of course, he provided the manna as well. And so God is reminding them, if you trust me, I will provide, whether literally or metaphorically. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together. Now, this makes me think that we're also getting elements of the new earth, the millennial period, when there are prophecies describing how in the new earth, there's not going to be wilderness, there's not going to be deserts anymore, because there's going to be water everywhere, plenty of it. And so all these trees will be plenteous because there'll be plenty of water. Verse 20, that they may see and know, may consider and understand together that the hand of He who is has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it. So the message is, trust me, and I will work it out. Verse 21, set forth your case, says He who is. Bring your proofs, says the King of Jacob. The case here is the word that we've seen before, reeb in Hebrew. It means a lawsuit. So God's saying, come on, let's go to court. Put on your best case to explain to me why you don't trust me, why you want to go and follow idols. Verse 22, let them bring them and tell us what will happen. So bring your little idols in here and let them predict the future. Or tell us the former things, what they are, that we may consider them. So tell about the deep past, you know? Past or future, either one, they should know, if they're gods, that we may know their outcome or declare to us the things to come. Only God can guarantee 100% accuracy in prophecy, that is, telling things ahead of time, or telling things that are unknown elsewhere. Okay? So God challenges the Israelis. Go ahead, bring your little gods and godlings to court, and let's see whether or not they can do 100% accuracy in what they have to say. Verse 23, tell us what's to come hereafter, that we may know that you're gods. Do good or do harm, that we may be dismayed and terrified. Yeah, go ahead and do some of your nastiness. You know, cause fire from the sky or earthquakes or whatever it is you think you can do. Do it. Do it. Come on. Prove you're a god. Tell us what is to come. Excuse me, verse 24. Behold, you are nothing, and your work is left than nothing. An abomination is he who chooses you. So God says, we already know how the court case would turn out. You guys would fail. You wouldn't be able to call the end from the beginning. And so that is why God alone should be paid attention to. And why he goes back to, in verse 25, something that we'll have to come back to next time because we're out of time, that I stirred up one from the north, and he has come from the rising of the sun, and he shall call upon my name. He shall trample on rulers as on mortar, as the potter treads clay. So God is going to bring somebody in judgment against sinners of the lower Middle East. But this one's going to have an interesting tie-in with God. And that'll come up much later in the passages here, who I think we're talking about. But we're out of time, so mark your place, and we'll get back here next time God gets us into his word.